Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis, and today we are going to talk about why your student loans are simply like living in California or New York City. Kind of a fun, weird concept, and we're going to break it down in detail. And I think you're going to be really relieved listening to this analogy and kind of listening to me go from start to finish about what student loans really are and why education actually costs so much money. But first, we're going to answer some listener questions. I would encourage you to submit your own questions during this time. Remember that you can do that by going to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So the first question we've got today is from a dental student asking about what you're supposed to do when you have such low interest rates right now compared to previous years that you might have borrowed in.
Hi, Travis. I'm a second-year dental student right now. Just for reference, it's July 2020. So we're living through the COVID-19 time. But what that means, as you know, is that the federal student loans right now are at 0% for the interest rate. So I have a question about what I should do with the loans that I'm about to receive for this next school year for 2020-2021 school year. I have $90,000 in loans from my first year of dental school. Half of that $90,000 is in a 6% loan, and the other half is in a 7% interest rate loan. Obviously, those interest rates are at 0% right now until September 31st, I think, which you mentioned might be extended. But assuming that it's not, those two same loans this year will be at 4 and 5% respectively. My question is, should I take out max loans this year and try to pay off that the principal on that 7% interest rate loan, since that is a pretty bad percentage? And this year, like, the percentages will be better with 4 and 5%. Or should I take out max loans and invest that money? Or should I not take out max loans and just kind of not do any of the stuff with the money and just kind of forget about it? Thank you.
Think about how low interest rates are on federal student loans this year. About 4.5% for Stafford, about 5.5% for Grad Plus. That's really low. That's, you know, about 1 or 2% lower than the typical average for other years. And so with interest rates that low, does that mean that you should borrow the max this year and try to pay off older loans? The answer to that is no. You do want to borrow the maximum for dental school loans for a couple reasons. The majority of dentists are going to be better off going for forgiveness. So that's the first thing. In the dental profession, most people are going to be better off going for forgiveness instead of full repayment. So given that that's the case, it's a lot more likely that you're going to go for forgiveness instead of paying it back. So that means that thinking about your student loans, worrying about the interest rate, is the wrong way to think about the problem. You should be thinking about, how am I going to make sure that I take out as much as possible while focusing my efforts on learning as much as I can on becoming a business owner and on trying to build up my emergency savings, about not having any car loans, not having any credit card debt, trying to avoid personal loans. That's the thing that you should be prioritizing. So what I would say is, worst case scenario, you're going to have some loans at a little bit higher interest rates. Even if you took out loans that you didn't need and you put it in the bank and you're locking in negative 6% per year on that money. Say you have $100,000, right? Well, that $6,000 per year interest over 4 years is 24 grand. Now, that's a lot, but that's really kind of a quarter of your first year earnings. It's not the end of the world. And that's if you're talking about taking out $100,000 or not taking on $100,000. That's a huge difference. You know, we're talking about, should you borrow an extra 20 grand or something like that? So the answer I would say is, don't worry about the amount that you have in loans for reasons that we'll discuss on this podcast episode. Take out as much as you can. And don't try to take out loans and pay off older loans. That's probably not a great strategy. You know, you probably just want to take out the maximum in general, and so you can get the most forgiven. So the only exception to that rule would be, let's say that you have support from a spouse or a family member that would cover living expenses. And let's say you're only taking out tuition, and let's say you're doing that at a school that's an in-state public university at one of the lowest cost dental schools in the country. So if you're at one of the lowest cost dental schools in the country, and you've got assistance on living expenses, and you're expecting to come out with, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 in debt, well then, yeah, I mean, maybe it makes sense if you weren't taking the maximum before to take out the maximum to pay off some of those older, higher interest loans. But remember that they're not even doing that. They're not even charging interest until at some point, probably in 2021, is when they'll start interest again on federal student loans. So you're not really getting any benefit by taking out extra loans and putting it towards older loans. I would, in fact, just keep that money in the bank account where you're going to earn a positive interest rate, which is going to be more than zero. And then when they start charging interest again and you get a little bit better idea in 2021 of what path you're going to choose in terms of going for forgiveness versus refinancing, well, then you might consider paying off older loans. But in general, it's a bad idea. And now we have a question about refinancing as an international student.
Hi, Travis. I have a question with regards to international students refinancing private loans. I was an international student whilst I was in dental school and graduated in 2017. I graduated with $250,000 of student loans with Discover, and I was able to refinance the max of 100K with SoFi because of my immigration status. I'm currently at about 70K remaining with SoFi, and I did try to refinance an extra 20K to bring myself back to 100, and they actually didn't allow me to. They said that I needed to complete the loan balance or the loan that I was in currently before I could refinance any additional amounts. And from what I know, they are the only company that did allow folks who are international or green card holders, to be more specific, to refinance student loans. Do you have any more feedback on what other companies might allow that? The remaining amount I have with Discover, which is about 70K, is sitting at about 6 point something, almost 7%. So I'd really like to get that refinanced and hopefully have everything, you know, in the 3 to 4% if possible. So I'd love to get some feedback on that. And if you have any insight on folks who are on green cards and what their refinancing options are with some of these companies out there. Thank you. Thank you for all the work that you do. It is much appreciated.
So this is a good question, because when you are an international student, a lot of times what we see happen is you're not eligible for federal student loans. And a lot of these programs are pretty expensive. So kind of one common pathway that I know of is somebody will come over and go to basically an international dentist training program at a dental school in the U.S. to try to become a licensed dentist in the United States. And they'll go to that program, and a lot of times they'll have to take out a co-signed private loan, because it's, you know, the lenders will not give you a loan unless you have a U.S.-based co-signer to get the loan in the first place. So I'm going to guess that our listener probably needed a co-signer to get that loan with Discover. And now she's graduated, she's got, you know, a six-figure amount of debt at a high interest rate, and she wants to get that interest lower, which makes a lot of sense. The reality is it's a case-by-case basis for these companies in terms of refinancing international students. I looked at a couple different companies. I looked at Laurel Road. They said that resident aliens were eligible. So that legal term, resident alien, I'm not an immigration expert, but whatever that means, those people are eligible. Common Bond, I looked their answer up. It gives a little bit more detailed answer. It says if you have a H-1B, a J-1, an L-2, E-2, or E-3 visa, then you are eligible for student loan refinancing. So that's the formal answer. In reality, you know, I would not be too surprised if we're seeing with the pandemic, some of these companies tighten up their eligibility and their underwriting standards. So they may not announce it publicly, they may not have changed their websites, but if you're not getting approved, there's a decent chance that one of the reasons, as long as you have a green card, one of the reasons could simply be these companies have tightened down the latches a little bit as to who can actually get access to those loans. So in normal times, I think some of these companies were kind of making the criteria a little bit looser as to who could qualify, but I think that that's probably what's going on. So I would just recommend that you check out several of the companies on our list. If you go to studentloanplanner.com/refi, you know, you want to apply at least to everybody in the table, because those folks tend to do millions of dollars a month in loan volume for our listeners, our readers in our community. And then if you want to be doubly sure, you want to check all of those companies that we list on our refinancing guide on our website that you can find. You should really be refinancing if you have private student loans. You're making a mistake if you don't try to refinance private student loans right now. 30-year mortgages are below 3%, and you're going to see that reflected in student loan refinancing rates as well. So anybody with private student loans, please look at refinancing. Even if you've done it 6 months ago, you know, the rates have really fallen quite a bit. You know, I'm seeing people get some really absurdly good rates right now if you already have private student loans. So, you know, again, go to studentloanplanner.com/refi to check out those rates, but hopefully somebody will approve you. Now we've got a question from Forrest about taking on Grad Plus loans.
Hey, Travis, I've been listening to your show for about 5 or 6 months now and caught up to almost all the episodes. It's been great and I've learned a ton. I'm currently set to graduate at the end of this year from a chiropractic school. I'm curious what your thoughts are about taking out Grad Plus loans when students are planning on going towards one of the income-driven repayment plans. Do you still suggest they only take out what they need? Do you tell them that it doesn't matter so much how much you take out since you're going for forgiveness anyway? What are your thoughts on that? For me, I have been taking out the fewest amount of Grad Plus loans I can because my mentality was to pay off the student loans when I graduate. But now that I'm moving towards income-driven repayment, I'm beginning to wonder if I could take out more Grad Plus loans and really stress about it less because I am moving toward that repayment instead of, or moving toward forgiveness instead of paying it off. Anyway, thanks for everything. I have loved all the information you've provided in this show, and it has definitely reduced my stress in worrying about paying off my student loans. So thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Here's my answer to that. You should take out absolutely as much as you possibly can without any regret, fear, anxiety, or any kind of moral aversion. Okay. And the reason is because if you're going to go to a chiropractic college, and if you take out the maximum for Stafford loans, then you're going to take out around $20,500 per year, I believe. So you're probably going to end up, if you only take out Stafford loans and you just work your butt off to try to keep your debt down to a minimum while you're in school, you're still going to come out with $100,000. And that's if you are extremely frugal. That's if you're living in a cardboard box and working, you know, night shift, doing whatever people do to make side hustle incomes during the pandemic, I guess Uber Eats or something. I mean, so if you're just really hustling, you might come out with $100,000. And here's the crazy part. Most chiropractors earn $50,000 to $60,000 a year. And that's kind of during most of their careers, even if they become practice owners, because of write-offs, their taxable income ends up being in that range. So even if you only owed $100,000, you're still better off as a chiropractor going for student loan forgiveness, even if you don't have very much debt. And so that tells me that if you're going to take out Grad Plus loans, you shouldn't be taking out a moderate amount, which sounds like terrible advice. But in the reality, if you're going to go for forgiveness, it doesn't matter if you have $100,000 or if you have $500,000. It's the same strategy. The only difference is the tax bomb that you'll owe, which is really not that significant in terms of planning for it. If you plan for it over time and you have a clear plan on what to do. And so that tax bomb is something that also, frankly, I expect is probably not even going to be owed for most people once you get future legislation that takes into account the realities of how screwed up our system is for student loans in America. That means that the chiropractic student should take out the maximum for Grad Plus loans, because it would be silly not to. It'd be like giving away free money. And also that money can go into things like paying off your car in full that you'll be able to drive for 10 years. It'll go towards things like making sure you have no credit card debt. It'll go towards things like maybe having a little bit of emergency funds saved up so that when you want to start a practice, you'll have some finances, some money, cash to draw on to get started with your career. And so to not take out the maximum for Grad Plus loans would be unnecessary. And I wouldn't necessarily say go put it all in the stock market. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying take the maximum. And if you have money left over, you know, nobody ever screwed over their lives because they had a little bit too much in savings and finances. Even if you're getting this, you know, you think, well, that's a terrible idea to take out an extra 20 grand when it's -6%. I'm just keeping it in my bank account. No, it's not, because you're thinking about this as a traditional debt that needs to be paid off, when in fact it's not going to be paid off. You're going to use forgiveness on it. So it's really like taking out $20,000 that says -6%, but in reality, it's just $20,000 that gets taxed, let's say at 40% in 20 years. So that $20,000 is $8,000 20 years from now. And so let me ask you a math question. I promise you it's pretty simple. Would you like me to give you $20,000 today in exchange for you giving me $8,000 in 20 years? The answer to that question would be heck freaking yeah. Particularly if that $8,000 that you have to give me back might not even be needed to be paid back. That's how ridiculous, you know, that trade is. It's an amazing trade once you've surpassed the threshold of being a clear forgiveness case or not. And this, you know, chiropractic college is very clear forgiveness case in most every single situation. Chiropractors actually lead the nation in debt to income ratios, unfortunately, just because of the chiropractic colleges. In a lot of cases, being real deceptive with the way they recruit and tell you what your future incomes are going to be. That doesn't mean you can't live a great, financially stable and secure life as a chiropractor. It just means that you have to do so in the context of knowing that forgiveness is probably the thing you're going to be doing. Wonderful question. If you want to ask a question, again, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Just type that into your phone and press record on your device and just say your question and press stop and it'll submit itself. And we'll have some more material so that we can, so I can riff on for the show for your entertainment. So now we're going to talk about the main topic of today's podcast. Student loans are simply like being a resident of California or New York City. That is their worst iteration. That is the worst it can possibly get, is you being a resident of California or New York from the perspective of what you're going to have to pay on your student loans. Let me kind of explain why I'm saying that. So you paid for a higher quality education than if you had just gone to high school, and you're having to pay more money because of that. So why do people go get an education in the first place? Why do people decide that, you know what, I want to do more than just get a high school degree? Well, let's look at some of the data that supports why people do this. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I'm going to use two different data points because we're like pre-pandemic world and post-pandemic world, right? So pre-pandemic data in 2019, if you asked, what is the unemployment rate by education level? If you look at people that had some high school education, the unemployment rate was 5%. For people with a high school degree, it was 4%, a bachelor's only 2%, and people with a professional or doctorate degree had a 1% unemployment rate. So that is extremely low, but notice that professional doctorate degree, 1% unemployment rate is way lower than 5%, which is people that have some high school. So now in the pandemic world, data from the St. Louis Federal Reserve says this as of July 2020. They reported that people with some high school education had a 15% unemployment rate, people with a bachelor's degree had an 8% unemployment rate, and people with a professional and doctorate degree had a 4% unemployment rate. So that means that the unemployment rate for people with, you know, a limited high school education, like people who high school dropouts, let's say, the high school dropout unemployment rate was four times as high as people with a professional or a doctorate education. And that's just talking about unemployment rate. That's not talking about the fact that, you know, if someone is employed, that person with that professional or doctorate degree is going to make five times as much money as the person with that limited high school education as well. Maybe five times is probably understating it. You know, maybe that's on average, but maybe people are making 10 times or even 20 times in some cases. You know, if you're a surgeon, let's say, as somebody that went to only get a high school education. So the value of your education is that you not only have higher lifetime earnings, you also have a far higher stability of your employment, which is extremely important to people's mental and physical and psychological health. Now, I'm not going to say that you don't have a huge amount of challenges. Okay, I'm not going to pretend here that having the amount of student debt that's equivalent to some people's mortgage is not a debilitating level of, causes a debilitating level of anxiety and stress and worry. I'm not going to say that's not a problem. It is. It's a huge problem. It's what we're dedicated to at Student Loan Planner of trying to fix. That's why we exist, is to try to make people know that their debt is not anything that needs to stop them from living their best life, and you shouldn't be stopped from living your best life because of your debt. So what is the deal with people still deciding to go get this education when we know that it costs more than a lot of people's mortgage, right? These are brain mortgages that people are signing up for. So let's think about debt to income ratio. Despite all of the noise, you know, contrary to this, we know that the denominator of the debt to income ratio, the income for getting a higher education, is really a good decision because, again, it's not just higher earnings, it's also income stability. So it's this combination of income stability and higher earnings, which combined together is a freaking amazing on average. I'm not saying everybody, you know, obviously some people maybe might be making a lower income than if they just done a bachelor's degree, but on average, that's that income that you get from a higher education is pure gold, literally, right? Or maybe pure Bitcoin, I don't know, whatever the right 2020 phrase is to use for cash money. It's really high quality, the decision to get a education in terms of what it gives you economically. But what about the cost? What about the debt on the debt to income ratio? So we'll discuss this, But the debt's not actually debt. It's a tax. And I'll explain why later. So let's talk about just assets in general. So why is what's happening with education like what's happening in the economy just in general for everything, really? Everything in the past 10 years has been all about flight to quality. And really maybe a little longer than that, but assets that are high quality assets have done way better than assets that are a little lower quality, you could say. I mean, think about this, right? What's performed extremely well in the past 10 years? Apple, Google, Facebook, Tesla, all these companies with amazing stories, Amazon, right? They're going to grow and they're going to take over the world. And this is just going to change the whole new paradigm. It's going to be totally different. And that's kind of what happened over the past 10-ish years is just the amount of value that people place on a great story, high income, high stability, that's going up, right? With the fear around automation, around, you know, jobs going offshore, around some of the kind of stress and worry in the white working class community that caused the election of President Trump. That fear has caused people to desire, you know, higher education more, not less, if you're capable of getting it. So also think about government bonds. Government bond yields have plummeted because people have bid up the prices of bonds enormously. And, you know, when bond prices go up, yields go down. That's how it works. So people want to put money in treasury bonds and are willing to even lose money after inflation to hold their money in something as safe as treasury bonds. So maybe it's the world's scarier. I don't know. But people are demanding safe assets way more than they have in the past. Why is that? So it seems like the world is less sure and less predictable than maybe it used to be. And so when that happens, I think your average person really likes safety and security, right? So the average person in America is fairly risk averse. Now, that's not to say that we have a significant minority that goes out and starts businesses and takes huge risks. And, you know, and that's also not to say that you didn't take a risk in deciding to pursue an education. You did. But in general, why do big companies have hundreds of thousands of employees? It's because the people like the stability. You like the benefits. You like being able to focus on your family, about having a nice house, about being able to pay the mortgage without having to stress out, about having to hop from job to job every year or two just to chase a dollar, right? A lot of people just really like, you know, having some sort of career stability and just not having to be super stressed about what you're doing for your career so you can focus on the things that matter the most to you. That's a lot of people out there that are like that. So that's why people like things like Social Security and pensions and things like that so much. That's why we really value those programs, is because it gives us a sense of stability and security. And, you know, if you think about the math behind this, you know, Social Security from a math perspective, if you know how to invest, is actually not that good of a deal for higher income people. It's something that you'd actually be much better off if you could take that money and invest it yourself in your 401k, and then that would probably be worth a lot more money than what you're going to get in return, particularly for you if you're younger, like I am, right? So if you're young, 20s, 30s, 40s, we know that Social Security benefits are probably going to need to be trimmed because of how expensive they are already for our parents and grandparents. So pensions too. I mean, so if you think about, you know, safety, people really value safety. So that in part kind of describes what's going on here. We see a riskier world. We see education that maintains and even has expanded its lead, you could say, compared to lower education, low-skilled jobs, right? The difference, the haves and the have-nots, the inequality in society, that's increased. And the risk premium that you get, the extra income that you get from being, you know, a skilled worker compared to an unskilled worker has really increased. And so people, you know, because there's been this flight to quality and flight to safety in the overall broad economy, people are more willing to pay higher amounts of money for a high quality asset like an education. And that would be true regardless of what's going on with student loans and the access to student loans. So already people would want to bid up the price of education just in general because of everything going on, the secular trends in the economy. So one comedian I like watching, Hasan Minhaj from Netflix, kind of jokes about how parents want a guaranteed path to the middle and upper middle class for their kids. You know, he joked that as an immigrant, you know, your parents, you know, only respect your work if it's outside the traditional doctor, lawyer, engineer sort of trifecta, if you're making millions of dollars, and then they come around and then they're suddenly proud of you. He's joking, but he's also kind of not, because I experienced this a bit personally. So my wife is Asian, Canadian American, and her parents were born overseas or first generation immigrants. And, you know, when I was discussing getting married with my wife, my future in-laws did not approve because I was a small business owner, which what the heck does that mean? But I was also just doing a little bit of everything at the time. This is several years ago. I was just blogging. I was writing. I had done a lot of traveling over that prior year. And it wasn't nearly as stable, secure, and predictable as having a well-paying bond trader job, right? So they're kind of like, yeah, we don't really think that you should marry our daughter because you don't really have a predictable guaranteed income. And that's something that's concerning to us, right? So again, people don't understand the paths a lot of times outside of a traditional education. So you kind of just encourage people to, at least if you have this, you know, professional degree, you know, your kid will be safe, right? So there's also pressure from society, I think, way more than there used to be on getting one of these higher paying professional jobs. So anyways, people's education is getting ridiculously expensive. Partly that's because of the increase in demand, which I've covered, but it's also partly because of the increase in supply of capital that people can access now because the federal government does not put any limits on what you can borrow for your education. So they will give you as much as the school asks for, and the school knows the demand is way higher because of the demand for a higher quality education and the asset value of that degree. They know that's way up, and they also know that they can charge as much as they want to, and they also know that you will be able to pay that loan instead of needing to pay 1% a month of what you borrow, which is kind of the old system. They know that you can pay 10% of your income when you graduate, and they know that that 10% of income is even, you can even game that and pay even less. So that's why the education's price has gone way up too. So why do people still go up and just fill the seats? Why are people not pushing back and protesting and weeping and screaming at their colleges for what they're doing to them? People are asking colleges right now during the pandemic to cut tuition prices because of this pandemic sort of style of Zoom learning that's not worth $50,000 a year. So why are people continuing to do it? And it's because it's the safe option, and it's because people value that higher education degree that much, and people have still not been willing to opt out of the system because of the benefits of the system and the risk associated with not pursuing a degree program and going down the path that everybody else is going down. So let's talk about the numerator in the debt-to-income ratio. So we talked about how the income and the quality of that income is really high, which makes people want to pursue a higher education. So let's talk about the numerator, the debt, in that debt-to-income ratio, because I said the debt is a tax, not a debt. Education and a degree is a higher quality path to guaranteed employment security and higher earnings. Pre-pandemic, it's like, I wonder if we'll have a phrase to talk about this one day, like pre-COVID and post-COVID era. I don't know, it's going to be interesting. But a lot of people before COVID liked the higher quality of life in a place with great weather, like California. I mean, I've visited California, never lived there, but I visited a bit, and I know that there's amazing weather in California. Good enough weather, you would probably be willing to pay more money to live in a place with great weather like that compared to 6 months a year of snow. I'm joking around a little bit, but you know, it's kind of true. People certainly mention that a lot as to motivations of what drew them to California. And also maybe you'd rather pay more money to live in a place with huge proximity to entertainment options and great job opportunities and amazing food atmosphere, you know, easy travel, right? And so that's a place like New York City. But people pay a lot higher taxes to live in those kind of places compared to living in middle of nowhere, you know, in Texas or Florida, right? So how much more do you pay in taxes to live in California or New York? So people a lot of times are not aware of this, but your marginal tax rate for at the state and local level, if you're a middle-class person in California, you're paying about 10% in taxes. That's really high if you think about it compared to the fact that, you know, if you're at that same income level, you might only be paying like 22 or 24 to the federal government and you're paying 10 to California. That's a pretty big chunk. Now for New York City, you're paying 6 for the state generally and about 4 for local. So that's a total of about 10% there. So in general, you're going to lose about 10% of your income to living in a place that's really wonderful to live in, like New York City or California. And obviously, it's maybe different with COVID, people's assessment of living in some of these bigger cities in those places, but not too much long term. I think, you know, once this pandemic, once we have a vaccine, people are still going to want to live in amazing big cities and places with beautiful weather. That's still going to be a thing. So, you know, Cali, New York, higher quality lifestyle, people pay more for that value that they get out of living in a place like that. So in places, you know, like Texas, Tennessee, Florida, Washington State, you pay 0% income taxes. But just to say a little joke here for a second, my wife says Florida is, you know, hot and full of strip malls and people who, you know, eat other people's faces. So she could never live in Florida. That's hurtful to me. I'm from Florida. I love Florida. I think it's beautiful. But, you know, a lot of people don't like the, you know, the fact that, you know, instead of a food atmosphere, you know, if you're in kind of a suburban part of Florida, you just might have a gazillion chains and that's your food atmosphere, you know? So in general, you know, your average highly educated person is probably going to say California and New York over Florida at the same cost. So let's talk about that numerator of educational debt and the debt to income ratio. And let's talk about some specific examples, because I've said that having student loans is simply like living in California or New York. So what do I mean by that? So let's look at a chiropractor who's got $50,000 of income and $250,000 of debt. And this chiropractor, let's say, is making, again, $50,000 of income, $250,000 of debt. This chiropractor has got to pay 10% of her discretionary income when she graduates. So what does that mean, 10% of discretionary income? Well, you look for a deduction first based on your family size. So for her, she's going to get $20,000 of income before she has to pay anything on her student loans. So that means if she's making 50, she'll get a $20,000 amount before she pays 10%. So 50,000 minus 20,000 is 30, and that 30,000 is what she'll pay 10% on, because that's the discretionary income that she makes. You know, discretionary income is always lower than your actual income. So 10% of 30,000 is 3,000. And if I take 3,000 divided by 50,000, that's 6%. So her payments annually on her student loans are actually equal to 6% of her pre-tax income instead of 10% of her income. That's because it's 10% of discretionary income, not 10% of your income. So 6% is the required payment she has to make on her student loans. In addition, if she's going to work in a private practice, then her $250,000 of debt is going to grow and she's going to go owe a huge tax bomb on that, right? People always misunderstand how student loan debt grows. It doesn't compound. It grows at a linear interest rate because it's simple interest, because that's just the definition. You know, there's no rational math reason for this. It's just that's how they defined the way the interest grows in the program, and the taxpayer, you know, which you are one, obviously, subsidizes that. Now, the balance, the tax bomb that we think that she would owe would be around $200,000. So how do you prepare for owing $200,000 in taxes in 20 years? You can simply save up for that on a monthly basis, right? So if we do the math, we can find that the chiropractor here has got to save about $4,000 per year over 20 years, you know, increase that with inflation and invest that instead of putting it into the bank. And if you do those things, then that, you know, total investment is going to probably be about $200,000 20 years from now. So $4,000 a year, that kind of works out to about 8% of her income. So 6% is required, and 8% is what she'd have to pay for the tax bomb in this case each year for the 20 years. So the combined percentage, 6 + 8 is 14%. So remember California and New York? I said that was 10%. So if this chiropractor is living in Florida, then this person is kind of like a chiropractor that lives in New York or California with no student loans. Think about that for a second. You know, if you're living, you know, in a no income tax state as a chiropractor and you're making about the same amount of money, well, then somebody who loses 10% of their income to state income taxes, well, that's kind of similar to losing 14% due to your student loans, right? And remember that I think that there's a pretty strong likelihood that the tax bomb is going to be wiped away one day. I think that there's a pretty good likelihood that some future moderate Republican or Senate, kind of Republican Senate or Democratic president will pass legislation to eliminate the tax bomb forever. I think that'll happen at some point. So if that happened, then the student loans for that chiropractor would simply be a 6% income tax, and that's it. If you had, you know, Vice President Biden win and passed his 5% of income to student loans program, well, then, you know, this person would only have to pay 3% of their income instead of 6. So it could be as low as 3. But right now, today, in today's rules, it's 14. And realistically, I think the 8% they're saving for the tax bump, I think they'll just get to keep that. So in that case, the person with 250 grand, five times her income in student loan debt, right? An absolutely abysmal numerator in the debt to income ratio stat. That person financially is better off than somebody who is a chiropractor living in New York or California financially, most likely. And they're particularly better off if you look at the difference in cost of living in terms of what kind of lifestyle that person can live. In Florida, that person, she might even be able to buy a house. But, you know, heck no, that's not happening in a place like New York City or California, right? So this person has $250,000 of student loans, and they're better off than somebody whose mom or dad paid for their student loans, paid for their education completely. That's kind of crazy, isn't it? It's really nutso. Now, let's talk about a different case. Let's talk about a physician, and we'll say this physician's an OBGYN pursuing public service loan forgiveness. We'll say she's living in a community property state like California. Let's say she's, you know, maybe at UCLA Health or something like that. And let's say she's got a stay-at-home spouse who owes no debt, and so she's the only income earner for the family. So in that case, remember the breadwinner loophole. I've talked about this in other podcast episodes, but the breadwinner loophole basically says that if your spouse has no student loans and less income than you, you can file separately and split the income down the middle and then just pay off of just half of that household income instead of just your income. So if she did that, she could get her payment down to about $20 a month as a resident and $500 a month as an attending. The normal amount would be like $300 a month as a resident and like $1,500 a month as an attending. So she can really cut her payment really drastically by using that loophole. So that works out to about 2.5% of her pay. So yeah, she's living in California, but her debt that she has to deal with is only 2.5% of her earnings. That is lower than any state income tax that I'm aware of, right? And that's super low, and there's no tax bomb because in the PSLF situation, you don't have to pay income taxes in the forgiven balance, right? So this is 2.5% of her pay for 10 years. I mean, if you wanted just an explanation of why the student loan system is so messed up, right? How is it that a chiropractor is going to pay 14% of her income for 20 years, and then a physician that makes four times as much money is going to pay 2.5% of her pay for 10 years? It's just a system that doesn't have any rational basis for why you're giving one person a subsidy and another person, you know, no subsidy or less subsidy. So that's one thing that I think you're going to see long term, everything sort of move to one system. Maybe you'll get, you know, instead of tax-free forgiveness after 10 years, you might get more like phased forgiveness, people being given $10,000 a year or something like that. Because we know that the system rewards higher income people with higher debt than lower income people with lower debt. We know that the people getting the biggest loan forgiveness benefits are higher income professionals, not police officers, teachers, firefighters. Those are always the stories they tell, right, when you're discussing these programs. But I think a lot of proponents of PSLF and programs like this are just simply not aware of the program they designed. And so I think that, you know, when you have progressives find out that most of this benefit's going to higher income people, they're not going to be happy with keeping the status quo. Also, I think when you find out about the cost of all these forgiveness programs, I think, you know, conservatives are going to be unhappy. So, you know, it's not going to impact you. It's not going to impact you going towards forgiveness, but it could certainly impact the future of what the future looks like. But I'm just telling you what today looks like. Today is, you know, that somebody could pay as little as 2% towards their income, towards their student loans, or, you know, as maybe the max level is probably around 15% if you're including tax bomb savings. What about another case? What about someone who's a single big law attorney in New York? We'll say that this person earns $250,000 and owes $200,000 of student loans. In this case, his repay payment would be more than the 10-year plan. So if his repay payment is more than the 10-year plan, well, he'd rather just refinance and pay it off. And that's because the refinancing payment is probably less than 10% of his income. So even if you're making a lot of money, your worst case scenario is still that your student loans are just a tax. And if that payment is so high that you're like, wow, I'm just paying 6 or 7% interest and I'm just going to pay this loan off eventually at a higher interest rate, well, then you'd rather just have a flat monthly payment because it's a lower percent of your income that way to get a lower interest rate and just get rid of it. So, you know, think about Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. They're not going to want to pay 10% of their income towards student loans, right? They're going to want to pay $2,000 a month. So worst case scenario, your debt is a tax and not a debt. And, you know, higher education prices are not going to go down anytime soon, unfortunately. The schools have absolutely no reason to cut prices. And why is that? Well, we've covered it. It's because of the components of the debt-to-income ratio of education. So we have the income from education being as good now as it's been pretty much ever, especially compared to the alternative, compared to bachelor's degree holders, compared to people with high school educations. Your stability and your incomes are much better in times of turmoil in general than they've really ever been. So you want a professional education if you're, you know, a little bit more risk averse, which most people don't love going out and trying to start their own company because that's risky. So the other reason is because debt is really a tax and not a debt. So that means that, you know, here's your trade-off. Okay, you've got this knowledge that getting an education is one of the smartest things you can do because of the higher earnings, the higher stability, which we've covered. And so when you're looking at the cost of getting education, the worst case scenario is that that debt is a tax. So you're going to lose anywhere from, on average, 2 to 15% of your income towards student loans when accounting for the tax bomb and all the tricks that you can do to minimize that payment. On average, I've seen 8 to 12% being the typical total cost of people pursuing forgiveness. And that 8 to 12% tax, if you will, is anywhere between 10 years if you're going for PSLF or 20 or 25 if you're going for forgiveness in the private sector. So you've got a tax of generally right around 10% maybe on average if you include the required payment plus the tax bomb savings, right? And that's going to last for the duration of your forgiveness program, that 10 to 25 years, let's say, is the tax that you'll have to pay for your student loans. So let me ask you this. Would you pay, let's say your required payment ends up being 8% of your pay, and let's say your tax bomb savings, the spreadsheet says that, you know, our spreadsheet says you can save 4% of your pay and you're going to have enough for the tax bomb. So 8 plus 4 is 12%. Okay. So I've got a deal for you. You've got a bachelor's degree. You can go work as a lab tech and make $50,000 a year and you have no student loans. Well, actually, that's not true. You have $30,000 from your undergrad degree. So you've got $30,000 of student loans. You'll have to pay $300 a month on that for 10 years. And you've got $50,000 of income. Alternatively, here's the other option behind door number two. You can go to dental school. And you can make a starting salary of $120,000, but realistically, if you become a practice owner, that'll be more like $200,000. And your cost of that, at worst, is going to be giving the government 12% of that income. So take $120,000, knock off 12%, you're still at a six-figure level of income, $100,000 to $105,000, let's say, or $100,000 to $110,000, just rough math there. So you're still making $100,000 income, and you have the upside of getting to becoming a practice owner where you can be a multimillionaire, especially if you live in a place that actually needs your services as a healthcare practitioner. And so you have no educational debt. You have a tax on your income is really what it is. It's dressed up like a debt. It looks like a debt. It quacks like a debt, but it's not a debt. It's a tax. You cannot pay your credit cards with 10% of your income. Visa will look at you like you have two heads, right? If you come to your bank and say, hey, I want to file my taxes separately from my spouse so I can cut my payment in half, and then I'm going to save up for the tax bomb that I'm owe you. Bank of America is going to say, huh? What are you talking about? That's not how debt works, except with student loans. And why is that? It's because the federal government is the number one lender and it determines all the rules. And so whenever that happens, the student loans no longer become a system where private underwriters are trying to get paid back, and you're going to have inequalities in that system. Lower income people, people of color, those are people that are going to get disadvantaged in a system like that, which is what justifies federal government involvement in the system, right? But the downside is, like, federal government involvement in that system is going to create really wacky incentives because it's just unpredictable the different things that the bureaucracy is going to create, right? And in this case, it's created a student loan sandwich where every time you come out with new rules, you just put the new layer of salami on the sandwich, and then, you know, you've got all these different people using different plans that have been created over 40, 50 years, right? So that's why it's such a mess. But once you really translate what's in the sandwich, what you realize is that at their worst, student loans are a tax, not a debt, which means that literally any education, you know, that provides a decent income, that's really what you're looking for. Any education that gives you something that you like doing and or gives you a better income than you would have without that education is literally a good investment. So if you want to go get a psychology doctorate from a for-profit psych school that has a bad track record, but the average incomes of the graduates are in the 60 to 70K range, and you have a psychology bachelor's degree, well, you're going to lose probably, like I said, 8 to 12% of your pay towards your student loans with all the math of the forgiveness programs for 20 years. And that's the worst case scenario. And so tell me this, would you rather have a doctorate degree, even if it's from a school that's maybe not as well regarded as getting a PhD from, you know, Yale or something? Would you rather have a PhD or a PsyD behind your name, or would you rather go to work in the corporate world with all of the uncertainties and risks associated with that, with a bachelor's degree in psychology where you're just trying to hustle to figure out what you're going to do without a clear path where you're going to have easy job stability and kind of a no-brainer path to making a good income? You're going to choose to go to graduate school. Now, if you're looking at being an engineer versus being a doctor, then, you know, that's a little bit different of analysis, right? Because you can start earning money right away, 22 years old. Maybe you can eventually make six figures as an engineer, maybe not as much money as you'd make as a physician, but you'll make it a lot sooner without all the stress and hours of doing residency without all that debt. But, you know, a lot of times comparing becoming, you know, a Facebook engineer to being a physician, even though you probably have that option when you're trying to make that decision. The thing is the kind of, I don't want to say it's the easy path because it requires a ton of work to get a professional degree and it takes a lot of effort. But I'm saying the sort of safe path, that's the right word, I think, the safe path of making that next decision is getting more education. And the thing is that safe path, historically and in today's environment, with all the unpredictability of the pandemic, that decision to get a higher level of education in general has paid off in a big way for people that have made it. And when people look at the cost of the debt and think about it in the traditional way that your uncle thinks about it, you think, oh my gosh, I'm screwed. Oh my gosh, I owe more than I earn. Oh my gosh, I'm never going to be able to buy a house or start a family. How can I pay $3,000 a month on my loans when I have to pay $3,000 a month for daycare? How am I going to ever retire when I'm starting earning money at 33 and all my other friends started at 22 that I went to undergrad with? And I have negative $300,000 to my name and they already have $100,000 in net worth and a house. Well, I've got news for you. You're not comparing yourself to others, right? Because if you were, then you'd have to look at comparing yourself to your friend that went to an associate degree program that you went to high school with. He's working as a nursing home assistant right now, wearing a spacesuit level of PPE, making $22 an hour and exposing themselves quite a lot to the risks of the pandemic, and without a lot of upside from an earnings perspective. So when you're comparing yourself, you can't just compare yourself to your most successful friends, you know, that had parents that paid for all the cost of their education, and you're comparing yourself to that person. Because if you're doing that, you're going to be unhappy for your entire life. I mean, I think that that's why you have a lot of the world's religions talk about the danger of coveting things, because it's this formula for being unhappy. So what I would suggest instead is, if you are going to compare yourself to really successful people, you know, compare yourself to what could have happened, which is that you would have no student loan debt, but half of your earnings. And because student loans are simply a tax instead of a debt, then you getting your education is probably one of the smartest and best decisions that you've ever made. And it's probably one of the best decisions that you ever could have made. The only thing that's going to change our student loan system from the outrageous costs that exist is if they actually regulate the schools and limit the schools about what they can charge. This is what every other country that has an income-based payment option does, is they tell the schools they can't charge whatever they want, because otherwise there's this huge incentive for the schools to just charge you anything because of how great the degree that you have really is in most cases. So just remember that your student loans are simply, at worst, just a tax. And what's the average tax that I've seen? 8 to 12% of your pay kind of covers the tax bomb plus the payments once you do all the math and work it out to what that kind of works out to. And 8 to 12%, guess what? That's like living in California, New York. And I have yet to have somebody send me an email that has said, I have severe debilitating anxiety and ulcers in my stomach because California takes 10% of my pay, but gives me gorgeous 70 degree weather year round. And so the educational degree that you have is the equivalent of the gorgeous weather of California versus the negative 40 degree winters of Montana that are associated with a lack of education. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's an analogy, right? So Some people love living in the 40 degree weather and, you know, doing the snow sports and all those things. But you get what I'm trying to say. that the degree decision you made is probably has that quality of living in the big city, living in, you know, the beautiful weather place, living in that higher quality lifestyle because of the comparison to the other options out there. And the worst case scenario is your debt is simply like paying taxes like a California or New York resident. So if you're really that upset about your debt, then move to a place with no income taxes, and then you're actually better off than somebody that lives in California or New York that has no student loans, which is just the most mind-blowing thing in the world. So thank you, everyone, for letting me go off on my high horse about this, because I think it's so compelling and it's so fascinating and it's so liberating, because then you no longer have to worry about your debt. You can realize how frankly blessed that you really truly are, even if you don't feel that way. And when you realize that your debt is just a tax and it's like a California, New York City tax, then you realize, well, actually, I like my income after paying that California, New York City tax, and I can go on and live my life and just focus on budgeting and saving for retirement and investing the right way and everything that people need to do anyway. Thank you so much. And if you need to figure out exactly what your student loans are as a tax to your life, obviously we can do that with the student loan consult. Our team would love to help. studentloanplanner.com/help. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful week.